Well, and I love that song because it takes me back to a moment in my life when I first found classical music. You know, I had heard it quite a bit going to sporting events. One of my best friend's dads, he was a pilot, and he was one of the calmest people I knew, and he listened to classical music all the time. And it wasn't for me back when I was a teenager. But I remember in college, as a junior and senior on Ohio State's campus, Amy and I were newly engaged, and we were trying to save money, so we were commuting to campus. And the most difficult thing about commuting to campus is you don't have a place in between classes to really be able to read, write, and do the other things for your next class that was upcoming. And so I often found myself trying to find a place to go to. Oftentimes it was the subway just off of campus where I could get a bite to eat, put on headphones, and begin to listen to classic music to drown out the rest of the noise and really allow me to focus on what I was trying to accomplish that moment. And ever since then, I've really enjoyed just being able to listen to the music, whether it's a stressful day at work, whether things are crazy at home, in my car ride, being able to put on the classical music and just kind of unwind, even if the kids in the back are like, "Dad, can you please change the channel?" And so that's what reminds me of classical music, and we're going to talk about one of the most famous composers, if not the most famous composer, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And the beauty of his story is how early it begins. And it's going to raise a lot of questions for us. You know, sometimes the questions that we ask in life are simple. Who needs picked up from practice? What's for dinner? What do you want to do this weekend? But sometimes life forces us to slow down and ask some deeper questions. And we're going to unpack some of those questions today. Our first question that we're going to wrestle with is this: who am I? Or better yet, am I enough? This was something that Mozart wrestled with very early on in his life. He was brilliant from the age of 8 when others were learning to read and to write. He was composing pieces. His dad created an environment when he learned how talented he was to really craft his skill set, to put him in front of audiences that could hear his brilliance, to hear the prodigy that his little boy was. Playing in front of kings and queens and other dignitaries was regular for him. And oftentimes he did it first as a volunteer and then as an employee of the courts of Salzburg. His first 2 years, he was under someone that was very amicable to someone, to having a young child as the chief organist, composer for this musical group. But after 2 years, things changed. There was a new leader, Prince Archbishop Colorado. And in that name, I think you could hear the weight of his title. Not only was he the head of the religious system there in Salzburg, he was also the governor. And he was young Mozart's boss. A young child trying to find himself, to perform, to come up with new pieces was regularly his job. And this system really began to constrain him. He would get regular requests to go off to other places and perform. And he would have to go to Prince Archbishop Colorado to ask permission. Can I play this piece that I composed for you? Can I perform? The other difficulty of this environment was that he was treated much like the help. Musicians in that day were not considered really valuable entities for their creative ability. In fact, they were part of the servants, wearing a uniform, eating in the back chamber with the cooks and the busboys. That was his life. And he really felt the tension from it. The Bible similarly wrestles with tough questions as well. We're going to look at a man named Paul today who helped a group called the Corinthians, the people that lived in the city of Corinth, wrestle with some deep questions as well. Namely, the question, what happens when I die? And there was an argument going around of, is this life all that there is, or is there something more? And speaking to this moment, Paul asks his own question when he says this. O death, where is your sting? To many of us, that sounds pretty ignorant. The sting is the finality, the finish. There's nothing more I can do. Or it sounds arrogant. I am better than any of the things that life throws at me, even the thing that we all face. We all have a timeline, and all of those timelines do have an end. So we wrestle with this question as Paul asks this question, O death, where is your sting? And I think Mozart wrestled with a bit of some questions as well as he was asking the question, am I enough? Am I only as good as my last performance? Am I really special? Do I really have special talents and abilities? Or am I just one of the help? Famously, Mozart would have regular battles with the archbishop, mostly asking for his release. He would later call it Salzburg slavery, the environment that he grew up in. And at the age of 25, he has a moment that a lot of us may have heard in the history of Mozart. He's been trying to get out for a while, and he walks into the archbishop's office, finally getting the opportunity to meet with him. Archbishop is there with the count, one of his helpers, and after a contentious conversation, they finally grant Mozart's release, freedom to produce what he wants, to be able to create and perform in front of who had invited him, who wanted to hear his music. And at the end of that meeting, as he was walking out the door, the count gave him a kick right in the backside, saying, we don't want you anymore. You're no good to us. You are only as good as those last performances, those last compositions, and guess what? They belong to us. Good luck. You see, when we wrestle with tough questions, oftentimes it leaves us feeling more empty than fulfilled. One of the next questions that Paul is going to ask, actually it's a response to his question, and it says this. It says, the sting of death is sin. Now, sin's a word that we don't really like to throw around. Here we go, you're going to impose your rules and morals and belief system on me, right? But I want to pose it as something more to us today. Something more than just simple disobedience, simply not performing. But when we view sin and when we view God as someone else we have to perform for, or a standard we have to obtain in order to be accepted, we create distance from, first of all, God, second of all, others around us, and finally, from ourselves. And we get this feeling that life is not as it was meant to be. There should be something more. And oftentimes that's what pulls us in and has us asking more questions. As we wrestle with that, we see that the things that give us the illusion of freedom, the ability to do what I want, when I want, however I want, oftentimes leave us feeling empty, not able to be able to wrestle with those things, not feeling life as it was truly meant to be. That's what we talk about when we mention the word sin, not the way that God intended. Mozart's rejection wasn't just professional. It was personal, set up by the system around him that had made everything about his performance, living up to the right standard, performing the right way, having the right communication, exactly how he's supposed to have it. I think we feel that as well, often. Am I only as good as my next sale? Am I only as good as how well my kids are performing? And those things often leave us feeling empty and asking more questions. The next question I have for you today is this: is God for me or against me? What is the view that you have of God? Does it look like Zeus on the right with a lightning bolt, ready to strike us down at any moment we veer off or disobey? Or does it look like this picture of Jesus, arms open, inviting us in to relationship? You see, oftentimes our interactions with individuals that share faith, talk about their religion, when we have those interactions like Mozart had with the Archbishop, they inform which of these images we see of God. And when we see this image of God as one ready to strike us down at a moment's notice, someone to perform for, a scorecard to meet, it paints a completely different picture than God intended. That verse continues and it says, "The strength of sin is the law." This all ties back to performance. This structure that's been set up, this set of rules that I'm now to be confined inside of. If I do well, he likes me. If I don't do well, uh-oh, here comes another lightning bolt. And as Mozart wrestled with some of these pictures of life, some of these difficulties of life, thinking about who is God and what does that mean, he also wrestled with the question of death. He famously, in 1791, which ended up being the final year of his life, composed several well-known pieces that you and I know today. One of them is Magic Flute, a light and airy song. Two others we'll hear today that I think help us wrestle with this question. What happens when I die? And is there more to this life? In 1791, he gets a knock on the door. His health is already starting to fail him. And there's this person that shows up in a gray suit. He doesn't know who it is, but he has a composition for Mozart, and it's a requiem. Requiem means funeral song. And there's a lot of mystery around this moment. He doesn't know who he's composing this funeral song for. He doesn't know when or if this person has already passed away, so he doesn't know when it's due. But he begins to compose it. And as his health is failing, he writes this piece known as Lacrimosa. As we begin to hear this piece inside of the Requiem, I want you to think about, what is my view of God? And does it feel something like this? Legend would have it that those were the final eight bars that Mozart ever composed with his own hand before he handed it off to his intern, Süssmayr. For those of you that don't speak Latin, here are the lyrics to that piece of music. Full of tears will be the day when from the ash will rise a guilty man to be judged. Kind of scary, isn't it? And oftentimes, that is the view that we have when we contemplate what happens when I die. The end, the finality of that entire piece. And yet we know from Mozart's life that this was not the only view he held. In fact, he had a very different view, and we find this in a letter he wrote to his father. In this letter, he wrote to his dad as he found out that his dad was on his deathbed, and he really wanted to get to him, but there was some distance, and he didn't know if he would be able to make it to him on time. And he writes these words. As death is, if we think about it soberly, the ultimate purpose of life. I have formed during the last few years such close relations with the best and truest friend of mankind, that his image is no longer terrifying to me, but indeed very soothing and consoling. What is it that could take us from the thought of full of tears will be the day to a dear, consoling friend. I can easily share with you those words, but I'd rather Mozart do it for himself. We've got another piece that he composed in 1791, if the band wants to come out. This piece is called Ave Verum Corpus, and it is Mozart's answer to how death can be a consoling friend. Probably didn't understand that either, did you? A much different picture. It says, "Hail, true body, born of the Virgin Mary, who suffered for us, was pierced, and from whose side water and blood poured. Be for us a foretaste in the trial of death." He talks about a personal God who didn't just sit up in the sky ready to zap us at a moment's notice, but came and entered our world, much like the Easter story we heard a couple weeks ago. He suffered for the things that we deserved. And I love the line, be for us a foretaste in the trial of death. The word foretaste that he uses is, give us this picture, help us to experience at least a little bit of the peace that comes after this, the joy that comes after this life. Would you let us experience that as we go through the difficulty of life, the madness? Would you give us some of that peace? I'm reminded of just regularly how in being a pastor, we're meeting with individuals throughout their life, but many as they await their passing. And in those moments, those that have experienced that personal Jesus, that personal relationship with him, they say some of the moments leading up to their passing are actually some of the sweetest moments that they've ever experienced in life. One woman said, I wish you could experience what I'm experiencing right now. Not the pain, but the peace that comes with it. And that reminds me of a group of friends of mine get together regularly, and we open the Bible and we see what it has to say for itself. We don't come in with a lot of preconceived notions and things like that, but we just open it up and say, all right, what is this telling us today? In our service that we do at 8:30 and 9:45, we were looking at James, which is the half-brother of Jesus. And he wrote a book in this library that we have. And as we were unpacking one of the conversations, one of the business leaders in that group said, you know, it reminds me of a moment where I got a problem on my desk, and it was Friday at 4 o'clock. And it was a big problem, a problem too big to be solved at 4 o'clock on Friday, unless everybody was going to hate me by making them stay late. So he had a few options. He could call his wife and say, honey, I'm staying late. I got a problem I got to solve right now. He could go home and worry about it, stress about it all weekend long, not be present with his kids, with his family. Or what he chose to do was to close the computer, to say that problem is gonna have to wait till Monday. Sure enough, when he arrived at the office on Monday, he opened the computer, and there was a reply from another business leader. And it said, hey, we actually saw this problem a few years ago in our division. Here's how it was solved. Here you go. The answer already existed, and he was able to have peace in the midst of it. That's how Paul finishes this letter, or at least this chapter. It says, but thanks be to God who gives us the victory through Jesus Christ. You see, peace doesn't come from having all the answers. Ultimately, peace comes from trusting the one that meets you inside of the questions. And that term, through Jesus Christ, means he's already accomplished it. All we have to do is trust him. So as the band comes out, we're going to be hearing a song, Let It Be. Because Jesus wants to meet you in the middle of the chaos, in the middle of the questions. He doesn't push away your questions. He invites you to ask those questions. And he says, I want to walk alongside you as you try and unpack the answers. So when you hear Mother Mary hear her son, Jesus, saying, you don't have to have all the answers. I'm here with you. Just trust in me. So like I said before, if you have questions, and questions are great. It helps us uncover things. It helps us be open to understanding that we don't have the answers. And so I'm going to be in the hearth room afterwards. We have groups of people that regularly meet around Horizons campus during the week to unpack our questions, to walk alongside each other in the midst of them. And so if that's something that interests you, I'd love to meet you there. Drew will be there as well. We can help find the place that's right for you. Would you pray with me? God, thank you that I don't have to have all the answers. Thank you that you do. Help me to know how to walk through life. Help me find a place to find the answers to the questions that I feel inside. And God, ultimately, help me to know you better. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks. Have a great week. We continue Maestros next week.